Well, we're returning to the life of Christ, and we're looking at, you know, these various doctrines, the truths that the Bible gives us about Christ. And there's always a danger when really getting serious about biblical doctrines. There's always a danger that we might study them kind of clinically, you know, like a chemist would study a chemical, like a doctor in training would study a disease in a person, and you kind of study these truths at a distance. In other words, they're separated from a person. They're separated from you. So you can study these truths, and they're wonderful, but they don't change you. You don't think of them in light of your needs. Or an even greater danger is that you study them detached from another person, detached from the person of God. So we can take individual doctrines like the attributes of God, that God is all-knowing, all-present, all-powerful. And it's easy to kind of talk of them in categories. So you could say it's almost philosophical. Here's a category, eternality. That some being could exist above time and its effects. And so we can discuss it in a small group. You can think about it. You know, you can read books about it. But you detach it from a person. So it's eternality that you've been kind of focusing on and not a person. When that happens, though, one thing that I find in my own life is that I don't fall more in love with the person. I kind of fall in love with the idea, the thing, even if it's a true idea, that God is eternal or that God is sovereign. And the other thing is that when it's not attached to a person, the biblical doctrines, the truths about God in particular, don't have the impact on you that they are meant to have when you take them apart from God and study them kind of isolated from God. Do you remember the wonderful description that Paul gives of the effect of the gospel, of the doctrines of our salvation in Romans 6? He says to the Romans that they once were dead, they once were slaves, but toward the end of chapter 6 he says, but you have been, and in the Greek it's very descriptive, you've been handed over to, you've been entrusted into the hands of the gospel. In other words, it's as if God takes us day by day, Sunday by Sunday, and hands us over to biblical truths. And these biblical truths are meant to fashion, to squish and mold and change you so that you're different at the end. Now, the one way to avoid this kind of clinical approach to these biblical truths is to keep them connected, or maybe we should say to see them most clearly in the person of Jesus Christ. So in other words, when we study the character of God, you can study that by looking at his son. And when that's the manner in which you approach it, then the truths aren't just clear, they're effective, all right? They impact you. They kick the door in. They allure you to follow them. They change the way you think, but they also change the way you live. And that's what we want to look at again today. We're looking at two of the attributes of God so perfectly expressed, the radiance of God's glory, the radiance of his perfection being seen in his son, and how he deals with people in the earliest days of his ministry. And the two attributes are the sovereignty of God and the faithfulness of God. Now, let's define those words simply. Sovereignty means that God has the right, not just the power, but the actual right to do all he wants to do. Okay, there is only one being that we've ever heard of or ever will hear of who has a right to do what he wants to do. Sovereignty. Then there is faithfulness. Faithfulness is a word that means that God is steady. In the Old Testament, when the word first shows up, it describes steady hands. So when things get a bit, when you start to get a bit tired, so-and-so has steady hands. They don't shake. When things are kind of crazy all around you, so-and-so has steady hands. That's the picture. God has steady hands. That is, God doesn't shift and change when everything around us and in us is shifting and changing. He's faithful, unalterably honest Now, the sovereignty of God and the faithfulness of God, those are perfect examples of truths that you could talk about and you could detach them from God. But they become very beautiful when we look at them in the person of Jesus Christ. And we see God ruling, God the Father ruling over all the activity of the earth so that what we call the providence of God, that invisible rule, even over sinful things, so that all of his promises will be made true. And to see that, we're going to look at, we're diving back into Matthew chapter 4, and we'll pick up in verse 12. You remember last week, we looked at Jesus in Nazareth, and the unbelieving people in Nazareth are so offended at what he says, they want to kill him, and they push him to the edge of a cliff. And then we read these wonderful words, he went his way. He just turns, the mob is there pushing, he turns and just walks right through the midst of them and walks away and goes to a little town of Capernaum. That's where we're starting. Matthew chapter 4, look at verse 12, and we'll read down through verse 17. Now, when Jesus heard that John had been taken into custody, he withdrew into Galilee. And leaving Nazareth, all right, so last week, Nazareth, leaving Nazareth, he came and settled in Capernaum, which is by the sea in the region of Zebulun and Naphtali. This was to fulfill what was spoken through Isaiah the prophet, the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali by the way of the sea, beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who were sitting in darkness saw a great light, and those who were sitting in the land and shadow of death, upon them a light dawned. From that time, Jesus began to preach and say, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Well, last week we ended with that statement by Luke that they tried to kill him, but he went his way. And that really, that could be the title for the sermon. He went his way. In spite of all that humanity wants to do to Jesus Christ at this point, he is determined for 33 years of life on the earth that he will live by one rule, not by what men think or even by what, as a man himself, what he might think would be best or not best. But the Son of God submits his human will to the divine will. He is God and man in one. And as man, he constantly prefers the Father's pleasure. What does the Father want me to do? And he does the Father's will, and he cannot be interfered with. Sometimes that can be pretty hard to see. When you look at these scenes, it looks as if Jesus Christ's ministry has gotten off to a bit of a slow start, right? He is proclaimed the Messiah by John the Baptist at his baptism. The Spirit enables him, comes to empower him to do everything he needs to do. Immediately, he spends 40 days by himself being tempted by the enemy. And then he begins his ministry. John chapters 1 through 4, talk about what he did in the first year of his ministry. He becomes more popular than John the Baptist. He's baptizing, although he doesn't baptize, his disciples are baptizing under his authority. More people than John is baptizing. John's crowds are getting smaller. Jesus' crowds are getting bigger. John, because he has offended Herod, is thrown into prison. Jesus realizes, John chapter 4 tells us, that the Pharisees, the religious leaders, not just the political leaders, but the religious leaders are becoming jealous of him and they're starting to oppose him. And it's not the right time for the crisis. That will come 2 years later and it will lead to his crucifixion. But now is not the Father's time for that. So he leaves there, and as he's headed back to Jerusalem, headed north, he stops at his hometown in Nazareth, and when he preaches to the people he grew up with, they're so offended at what he says, they try to kill him. It doesn't look like a great start to ministry. But that's if we look at it just on the earthly level. When you step back and see what God is doing, there's something very different happening. I mean, we have to ask ourselves, when Jesus leaves the south, Judea and Jerusalem and the capital, where there are so many people that need to hear the gospel, and he goes north to this region of Galilee, which is kind of a mixture of Jews and Gentiles, does he do it because he's a coward? Well, no, because when it is the Father's time, even though some of his disciples say, Jesus, you cannot go back to Jerusalem at this time. It's bad down there. They want to kill you. He goes and he hands his life over. And John, the gospel writer, tells us that no one took his life from him. And the Father doesn't even force him. He gives Jesus, the Son, the right to do it on his own initiative. And he does. It's not fear of man that drives him from the south to the north. It's not even a desire to be more effective. I mean, that would be understandable. You're in the capital city. The politicians and the church leaders are against you. And so you think, you know, if I could go somewhere else, and I would be more effective. I mean, the people would listen to me. So I'm going to go where I'm appreciated. But think about him traveling north. Do you remember he passed through Samaria? And he met the woman at the well. We talked about this last week. And the whole town, once they hear what she says about him, is interested enough to come and listen to him. And then he talks to the whole town. And then they turn to the lady and they say, first, we took some interest in Jesus because of what you said, but now we've heard him for ourselves. This is the Savior of the world, they say. That is one of the most clear statements of faith that we have so far in his ministry. And it doesn't even come from the Jews. It comes from Samaritans. And they plead with him to stay in their city and continue to teach because they are receptive. And Jesus tells them, no, I must go. My Father is sending me to other cities. And he turns and he goes to Nazareth. And rejected there, he goes to Capernaum. It's not a desire to be more effective that leads him to Capernaum, even though this will become the headquarters of his ministry. So here's the answer. Matthew gives us the hint, doesn't he? He quotes from the Old Testament. In fact, Isaiah chapter 9. Matthew quotes a promise that was made about 700 years before this, in the year 733 BC, best as we can tell. God made a promise to Israel that he would send happiness to an area that was very unhappy. He would send light. He would free them from their captor. He would give them his Messiah. And God is keeping his promise. Can you see that here? It's not the rage of offended Herod, the king, that moves Jesus to Capernaum. It's not the jealousy of the religious leaders. It's not even the arrogant pride and indifference of the people in Nazareth, his hometown. It's that God the Father made a promise 700 years prior to this. And God intends to keep his promise. So God rules over all these strange and even wicked decisions so that everything he has promised will come to pass. God rules over the wicked and the powerful, as well as the godly, so that the mercy he's promised would really be received. And that's why Matthew quotes that, to help us to understand it. Let me ask you before we go any further, is that the environment that you live in as a believer? I mean, it's not an effortless thing, is it? It is just so easy to wake up and think, what's happening to us this week, especially in the year 2020, we think, well, what's happening? That's the result of politicians. Or you could look around and you could say, what's happening is the result of religious leaders. I mean, as soon as the sermon is over and we walk out of the church, some of you talk about politicians. Did you hear what the governor said? It's not wrong, but really the governor isn't really in charge of us. And then others say, did you hear what John MacArthur did? Did you hear what Mark Dever said? But behind everything that occurs, whether we look up at politicians and religious leaders, or whether we look at our kids or our spouse or our coworkers and our boss, or whether we look in the mirror at our own decisions, it is easy to forget that behind all of these things, there is a God that is ruling through them all, to make sure that every promise he's ever made will be kept. Do you remember in the covenant that God made with Noah? Seems like a bit of a strange covenant, but we looked at it on a Wednesday night a number of months ago. That in this covenant, God says, because he looks at the heart of humanity, and he sees that from youth up, from a childhood up, humans just seem intent to be wicked. They are determined to do what they want to do and not what he wants to do. And because that is a fact, God makes a promise to preserve the world. That seems so strange. Why doesn't it say this? God looked on humanity and he saw there were a few really godly people, so he said, I won't destroy the earth. Why doesn't it say this? God looked at humanity and he saw that everyone seemed to be so selfish and wicked that he decided he would destroy the earth. This seems to be just the opposite of what we would think. God looked on humanity. He saw the wickedness of humanity. It just goes through all of us. And he promised to preserve the earth. He would not let the earth be destroyed. And you remember that the answer to that is so wonderful, that God in that covenant is saying to all creation, not just to believers, no matter how sinful and bad life gets on this planet, I will preserve it so that it will continue to exist until I have fulfilled every kind promise, particularly the sending of his son and the saving of a bride. And that's what we're seeing here when Jesus leaves Nazareth and goes into Capernaum. So can you live on that? Can you believe that God uses the worst decisions of Herod and the Pharisees to promote his mercy to Naphtali and Zebulun? Yeah, I mean, we read Matthew 4, we see that. But can you believe that God uses the worst decisions of Congress and bosses and church leaders today to bring mercy to people that would never think they deserved it? Well, let's go back to the original passage that Matthew quotes from. That's Isaiah chapter 9. Verses 1 through 7, and he just picks a few verses from there, but I want us to kind of get a running start and look at that. We're going to look at the bad news behind the good news, and that starts in chapter 8, verse 19. As I mentioned, most scholars think this is written about 733 BC, and that is 11 years before the complete conquest of Israel, the northern 10 tribes, by the Assyrian Empire. So let's get a little history lesson. You remember that after Solomon dies and his son Rehoboam becomes king, because of the idolatry that Solomon promoted toward the end of his life to please his wives, God promised that he would take most of the tribes away from the house of David. But because of his faithfulness to his promise to David, he would leave two. So Judah to the south, two tribes, 10 tribes to the north are now called Israel. Israel, Judah. Israel immediately goes into idolatry, much worse than the south. There's rarely a bright moment in the north from that point forward. And so centuries later, after so many warnings, Isaiah tells them on behalf of God that God is swiftly sending an enemy, and they will be the prey. And God will judge them for their idolatry. And that happens in 722. The Assyrian armies finally conquer the capital city, and they take the Jews out of there. They deport them. They take them captive, and they fill the land with other people. Before 722, in the year 733, now we're BC, so actually that's earlier, not later. 11 years before that, the very northern territory of Israel, all right, which from this point forward is just called Galilee. When we talk about Galilee, it's the north. The very northern tip of the Galilean land, the Assyrian armies come from the north. And so it's those areas, it's those towns, it's those cities, it's the area of the tribe of Naphtali and Zebulun that get attacked first. And so at the beginning of a political campaign that takes 11 years, they're the first ones to get the brunt of the Assyrian army. They're the first ones to be conquered. They're the first ones to see their men and boys cut down by the Assyrian armies. And they're the first ones to be chained up and dragged from their cities as families to who knows where. And that's what we're reading about in Isaiah 8. And then the hope that comes for that group of people in Isaiah 9. So look at Isaiah 8, verse 19. Let's look at the bad news. When they say to you, now God is saying, when the Jews say to Isaiah, or sorry, this saying, when the Jews say to their spiritual leaders, Consult the mediums and the spiritists who whisper and mutter. Should not a people consult their God? Should they consult the dead on behalf of the living? To the law and to the testimony. If they do not speak according to this word, it is because they have no dawn, no light. They will pass through the land hard pressed and famished. And it will turn out that when they are hungry, they will be enraged and curse their king and their God as they face upward. Then they will look to the earth and behold distress and darkness and gloom of anguish. And they will be driven away into darkness. Now that's the scene that I've just described. That's the Assyrians taking them away. Now notice some things here. Strangely, when God judges them and withdraws his wonderful nearness, and it says earlier in the chapter that God turns his face away from them, he hides his face from them. When God seems to be very far from the Jews in the north because of their idolatry, instead of seeking God, they go to the preachers and say, talk to the spiritists and the mediums. Now, these are people that would claim to have supernatural wisdom because they can contact the dead and the dead tell you how to live. Kind of like going to a palm reader today. And they take that very seriously. And Isaiah says to them, what are you doing talking to the dead? Should you consult the dead about how we're to live life today? It's nonsense. And if you go to your preacher and your preacher says, hold on, let me go talk to the holy man. And Isaiah uses words in the Hebrew that mock these people. They whisper and moan and it seems really spiritual. Something spiritual is happening. And then they tell you your fortune. And Isaiah says, if your spiritual leaders talk to these people and get their message from them, and instead of the word of God, the law and the testimony, it's because they themselves, your pastors, live in darkness. And they are as confused as you are about what to do next. And then comes the description of utter despair. Imagine a family. The Assyrian armies are on the border. All right, every family hears that their armies have gone to meet them, but the armies of Israel are being beaten and they're fleeing. And imagine the morning that you wake up, maybe before dawn, and dad and mom are at the window or at the door looking out, and they're concerned because the Israelite armies are fleeing the city. They're giving up the city. And the parents try to hide the children so they won't be taken, but it's too late. And the Assyrians arrive and they take mom and dad and put them in chains, and they find the children hiding and put them in chains. And through the darkness, they're led to some place they don't know where. And they're greatly distressed, Isaiah says, and they're in anguish and they become bitter. And mom and dad look up and they think of their political leaders who got them in this shape, and they bitterly curse the king. And then they think about God and they blame God and they bitterly curse God. And as they travel and they're starving, they look out across the earth, Isaiah says. They look at the land to see, is there any hope anywhere? And everywhere they look, it says this, behold distress and darkness and gloom of anguish, and they are driven into darkness. It's utter despair. It's the kind of darkness that the parent can never turn to the child and honestly say, look, guys, I know it's really bad, but it's going to be better soon. It'll get better. All they can say is, everywhere I look, guys, it's dark. It's to that group of idolatrous people who first felt the blow of God's judgment from Assyria that Isaiah in 7:33 says to them, you who are experiencing this terrible captivity, God will visit you one day and you will be filled with gladness. Look at chapter 9, verse 1. But there will be no more gloom for her who was in anguish. And in earlier times, he treated the land of Zebulun and Naphtali with contempt. But later on, he shall make it glorious by the way of the sea on the other side of the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. In the Hebrew language, the first part of the verse has no verbs. It doesn't actually say, and there will not be any more gloom or anguish. There's no verb. So it's, you understand the picture. It's like someone grabs you and they don't form complete sentences. They say, no more gloom, no more anguish, no more darkness, no more captivity. It's good news for these people in the northern region of Galilee. Now, we want to be spiritual realists. It's not good to have a religion that's based on, you know, positive thinking. It doesn't honor God to say, well, God, you know, God's just going to make it better. Well, we need facts. And so what follows in Isaiah 9, verse 2 through 7, is a series of facts. Look at what he says God will do. Verse 2, the people who walk in darkness will see a great light. Those who live in a dark land, the light will shine on them. You shall multiply the nation. You shall increase their gladness. They will be glad in your presence, as with the gladness of harvest, as when men rejoice, when they divide the spoil. For you shall break the yoke of their burden and the staff on their shoulders, the rod of their oppressors, as at the battle of Midian. For every boot of the booted warrior in the battle tumult and cloak rolled in blood will be for burning fuel for the fire. Wonderful description here. How will we ever be glad again? Because God promises, one day I will send light and gladness. I will break the power of your enemy over you and free you. And I will do this so thoroughly that the boots your soldiers wear and the clothes that are soaked in blood from a battle that they wear, your soldiers' gear, you won't need it ever again. So you can just take the army gear and burn it. How could that possibly be? Verse 6, for, that's the explanation, for a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called, now here's his royal titles, given to him when he's crowned. Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. It's a passage we've looked at so many times. There will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from then on and forevermore. That's the promise. These people in the far north, the first ones who are always seem to be treated with contempt by God, are now treated with favor and honored. How? A child will be born and he'll come to them and he will rule over all the world. All nations, all worlds, all galaxies. And he will rule forever and ever, and no one will replace him. And so you don't have to say, well, that sounds great, but that's not my king. That's just the king of the Jews. No, that's the king of every person who surrenders to him. And it would be great news, but kind of soured if we said, well, that's what God did 2,000 years ago, but now there's a new king that followed him, and since then there's just not been really any good kings. No, that's the king that never ends. And the only way this could be possible, Isaiah says, at the end of verse 7, is what? That the zeal of the Lord will accomplish it. That is, this white hot intensity in the character of God, this burning determination to do what he says he will do, is the reason that Jesus of Nazareth leaves Judea, leaves Herod's land, leaves the Pharisees, leaves Nazareth after an attempted murder, and goes and makes Capernaum the headquarters of his ministry for many months. God, in the intensity of his will, is keeping his promise. What about us? I cannot imagine a more simple and clear description of what sin has done to every one of us. I mean, it would be harder to find a better description. Think of it. God created humanity in a perfect place, like living in the city and in the house you built, living with land that you plowed, and it's about harvest time and money's coming in and everybody's happy and kids are born or grandchildren are born and they moved in beside you and the world's just so nice, and then the Assyrians come. Sin comes And our forefathers embraced it. And humanity was banished from the face of God because we, like Adam and Eve, are stained with sin. And we're affected by their decision. And we choose the same choices. As soon as we're able to choose, we choose ourselves. We embrace the same lies they did. We grow up far from God. It's not that we're not religious, but we go to people who are kind of like spiritists and mediums. I mean, we don't go to Madame So-and-so's palm reading, probably. If you do, please don't tell me you've ever done that. But I can't imagine you handed a lady $20 to look at your palm. But we go to people and we go from church to church until we find one that says what we want them to say. And we say, well, poor me. And the spiritual leader says, poor you. God's here for you and he just wants you to be happier. Or whatever they tell you, and you say, yeah, now that fits. That's what I've always thought. But sin continues to eat away at your life. And like these people that are captured and dragged away, it enslaves you. And no matter how hard you try to do better, you're still in its chains. The enemy's yoke over your shoulders has never been broken. You're starving and it's dark out there. It's spiritually confusing. I don't know what to do next. And there's a hopelessness that comes in the life of a person like that. It's like being in the dark and being dragged off and someone says to you, there will never again be another dawn. And you become bitter and you blame everybody else. Maybe you blame the politicians. Maybe you blame your boss. Maybe you blame your parents, your spouse, your situation. You blame God. And then Christ comes to the life, like he came to Capernaum that day, 2,000 years ago. And God is keeping promises he made not 700 years ago, but 2,700 years ago. And people that still sit in darkness in Mississippi, Christ enters the life and light comes. And they're freed from the rule of sin and in its deceit. And the child that was born 2,000 years ago rules over them. And the zeal of God, the white hot intensity of God when he decides to show mercy is behind all of it. Every single privilege that every single Christian today experiences is happening because God is keeping every promise he made 2,000 years ago. There's so much hope there. Look, when you look at Galilee, every time you read about Galilee in your Bible and you think, oh yeah, that's that north part. Can you remind yourself God kept a promise that he made 700 years earlier and that's why Jesus is walking those dirty streets of little fishing villages? And then can you say to yourself, I can trust him? Now, that's the hope. There is some shame here. Last week we mentioned it, so I won't spend long on it, but you do remember that at the end of his ministry, Jesus turns to the little towns in Galilee that were given this promise 700 years ago that the light would come and Christ is the light. And they are so indifferent. Just kind of, They hear Jesus preach. And they may not try to kill him like Nazareth did, but they just, I'm not sure. I'm not going to follow him today. Maybe some other day, not now. Every time they reject the claims of Christ by putting him off or arguing in their hearts against his words, they're not just rejecting a mercy that's there right now in front of their face. They're not just rejecting the kindness of God in the present moment. They are rejecting the kindness of God that has hunted them down over seven centuries. God kept his word. It is a terrible, it's a shameful thing to do when God keeps a 700-year-old promise to you that your forefathers never got to see being kept, and Christ brings hope to you for the Galileans to be disinterested. No wonder Jesus said that it will be easier for Sodom and Gomorrah in the judgment than for the people in Naphtali and Zebulun and Galilee and the part east of the Jordan and the part west on the Mediterranean Sea. What about us? Well, again, same application. Every time we hear the claims of Christ, every time we read the New Testament and we see these things and we say to him, well, I mean, look, it's not that I'm not against Jesus. I'm just not going to surrender today. Or I've still got some ideas. I think I can make life bearable. So hold on, God. You know, I'll do my best and then I'll come back to you if it doesn't work. And instead of just throwing it all in the dirt before him, all your favorite sins, all your rights, all your claims, all your religion in the dirt and say to him, I have nothing. I'm a beggar and an enemy. But you kept the 700-year-old promises to your enemies back when Christ walked the earth. And I am hoping that you'll keep the 2,700-year-old promises to your enemies today. But if you are indifferent, you don't have to be angry like Nazareth. Just be indifferent. You are not rejecting a kindness that started a few minutes ago at the beginning of the service. You are rejecting kindnesses that are based in promises 2,000 plus years. Think about what God has done to bring you the gospel. God keeps all of his word to all of those people, Old Testament and New Testament. God gives his word through the apostles who die and they seal the book with their blood. God has brought that book to you so you own a copy of the Bible. God has, through the centuries, saved moms and dads and children and pagans and nice religious people. God has saved them in the Middle East and in Europe and in Africa and in Asia. And he's even saved them. He sent the gospel to America. And God has done things so that this little church can exist, so that your parents know the name of Jesus Christ, so that young people in your school know Jesus Christ, so that people you go to work with tomorrow know Jesus Christ, so that you've heard of Jesus Christ. And if you say to yourself, yeah, but just not right now, you are rejecting a kindness. Kindnesses that are based in 2,000 plus years of God keeping his word. Now we're about to take the Lord's Supper, and I cannot think of a better way to respond to him if you're a believer. You're going to celebrate the faithfulness of God. In a sense, I want us to approach the Lord's Supper this morning in light of Matthew chapter 4. Think of what God did at Zebulun and Naphtali and in Galilee. 700 years later, he ruled over the wicked decisions of the earth's mighty so that his son's feet would walk down that street and the light would come to those people. When we take the Lord's Supper, two big things are always happening. Do this in remembrance of me. All right, look back at the cross, at the incarnation. God gave his son a body so he could obey in your place, die in your place, and you could be made right with him. Look back. Do this in remembrance of me. But he also says this, and as often as you do this, in remembrance of me, until I come. So think of this. Remembrance until. Remember me in the Lord's Supper. Remember what I did in the past, and then look forward. Do it until. So in the Lord's Supper, there's always that dual look. I look back and I look forward. The Christian has so many promises that God has made that have not yet been made complete. There's things he's yet to do. He's yet to come in his glory. He's yet to finish sanctifying you. He's yet to make a new heavens and new earth. He's yet to draw near to you, like Revelation describes, where the people of God are like a whole city that he moves into. The day of restoration that Peter preaches about in Acts has not yet happened. So when we take the Lord's Supper, we're remembering something. We're proclaiming to the world these things until he comes. We're looking forward. Can you take the Lord's Supper this morning in light of Matthew chapter 4? God will keep his word. So I'm going to take this Lord's Supper as a visible act of once again entrusting myself to the God that doesn't lie. Well, let's do that this morning. We're going to sing a hymn and then we'll take the Lord's Supper. Hymn 469.